I'm very happy now to welcome Mitch Tobin. He is the author of the new book, Endangered, Biodiversity on the Brink. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much for inviting me on the show.
So this is a book about biodiversity, the Endangered Species Act, and how human beings are affecting the environment, focusing on the Southwest. Why the Southwest?
Well, I was a newspaper reporter in Tucson, Arizona for about 7 years and mostly was covering the environment there. And so the book is set in the Southwest and focuses on Arizona and New Mexico. And I feel that it's actually a really good region to use as a case study or as a microcosm to examine the larger issues in terms of biodiversity protection, preventing extinctions, and also because it happens to have quite a few endangered species. There's a real concentration of biodiversity and endangered species here in the Southwest.
Despite it being such an arid climate.
Yeah, a lot of people who aren't from this part of the world are sort of surprised to hear that because people think of these very stark chasms and canyons where the geology rather than the biology seems most interesting. But it turns out that Arizona and New Mexico have an incredibly large number of species. I think it's third and fourth is the ranking of all 50 states. And that's even though neither state has any marine or coastal habitat. And the reason that the Southwest is so biologically diverse, and many of your listeners living in New Mexico know this, is that we have an incredible range of topography and elevation in the Southwest. And that gives rise to tremendous diversity of habitats and therefore species. And we also have very demanding weather in the Southwest, and species have evolved very unique, specialized survival strategies in order to cope with things like the very hot, dry weather.
As you've written in your book, almost every species that's ever lived on Earth is extinct now. And mm-hmm. we're going through a rapid extinction now. What's different now?
Well, we know that the Earth has been subject to a number of large extinction events. And you're right that more than 99% of the species that have ever lived on the Earth are gone forever. So extinction is nothing new. It's part of the natural cycle. But a lot of biologists feel that we're in a sixth major extinction event that's just started, and the primary cause is us. Some of these other extinction events, for example, have been caused by an asteroid impact, for instance. But this extinction crisis that we're facing now, the sixth one, is really entirely of our own making. And so species will naturally go extinct. There's sort of a background rate. But the rate now, it's difficult to say precisely, but some biologists think it's 1,000 times faster than what the natural rate of extinction is. Some people think it's even higher, 10,000. And if you add climate change into the mix, that's when people start really being concerned about losing a significant fraction of species that live on the Earth now.
There are so many ways that human beings are affecting the environment, and one of them that I was reading about in your book that I didn't know about was lead poisoning. Tell us about the California condors and other species that are getting poisoned by lead.
Yeah, lead has been outlawed from a lot of different things. We don't use it in gasoline or in paint or pencils, but lead is still used in rifle bullets. And what happens with the California condor is that it's a scavenger, and so it only eats dead animals. And in Arizona and California and the places where California condors have been reintroduced, the birds will find dead animals that have been shot by hunters and perhaps not recovered, or the gut piles have been left behind. And as they're picking through these carcasses and eating, they will ingest small fragments of lead bullets, because when a lead rifle bullet hits its target, it typically explodes into a lot of very small little pieces. And lead is obviously very, very toxic. That's why it's been outlawed from all these substances. And so the birds eat it unknowingly, and they get very sick, and they die. So for California condors, lead poisoning is now the number one source of mortality. And we've spent tens and tens of millions of dollars recovering this bird over the past couple of decades. And in many ways, it's really an incredible success story of the Endangered Species Act, because there were only about 22 left in the entire world, and all of them were recaptured and put into this very intensive captive breeding program. But now this lead poisoning threat still hangs over the head of this species like a sword of Damocles. And so you have every year California condors, and there aren't very many left in the world. There's only a couple hundred, and many of those are in captivity. Every year, California condors are dying because they're ingesting these lead bullets. And just recently, a couple of years ago, California finally took action and actually banned the use of lead rifle bullets in the range of the California condor. And instead, hunters used non-toxic alternatives. And those are sometimes slightly more expensive, but they perform just as well, if not better, than the lead alternative.
Well, and that whole story of the California condor, which you tell beautifully, I have to say, this is a wonderfully written book. You're a journalist who is on the ground telling stories, and you know, you have yourself in it just enough so that we feel that we're on the ground with you. But you were watching a California condor named 134, Condor 134, be transfused with blood from another condor, from another zoo that had been FedExed in, because this bird had eaten lead from a pile of guts, you know, a carcass that had been shot. And of course, the answer is not to outlaw hunting, because these animals do really rely on carcasses that have been left behind by hunters.
Yeah, the solution isn't banning hunting, because you're right. The birds actually do depend on deer and elk and other animals that are hunted. And I opened the book actually telling the story of this one bird, Condor 134. And the book opens in the Phoenix Zoo in the animal clinic there, which is sort of like an emergency room. And I walk in, and there's a veterinarian giving mouth-to-mouth resuscitation to a condor that has just gone through this blood transfusion. And to me, that epitomized a lot of what the Endangered Species Act is about, in that it in many ways serves as an emergency room. And when the patients arrive there, they're typically in really critical condition. And so when a species is actually finally listed under the Endangered Species Act and receives federal protection, typically, there are very few left of the plant or the animal, and so the job of recovering their numbers is incredibly difficult. We're always going to need an emergency room, and a lot of heroics and great things happen but in an emergency room, but that doesn't make for a healthcare system. And so my argument is that the Endangered Species Act, while it serves as an ER, it's not enough, and it's sort of a necessary but insufficient condition, and that we need much smarter policies to govern these other issues, for example, like lead in rifle bullets, to address the root causes of species endangerment. And we'll always need an ESA to perform these heroic acts and to act as a backstop, but it's simply not enough to attack the causes of why so many species are facing the threat of extinction.
The whole question of the condor and the eating of the lead, and this applies to other species as well besides the condor, but it points out, it's an illustration of the kind of politics that happen around trying to preserve species and not just save them, you know, by giving them mouth-to-mouth and transfusions. I mean, it's crazy to read that we're doing this to animals. But when you try to, for example, outlaw lead bullets, you get into problems with the NRA saying there's not enough science to prove that that's where the lead poisoning is coming from, when there just point blank is enough science.
Yeah, I think it's very, very clear that these birds are dying from lead poisoning. After all, they're actually pulling the fragments of lead bullets out of these birds' digestive tracts. And so there was an effort by the NRA to block this effort in California to ban lead bullets, but eventually Arnold Schwarzenegger, the governor, did sign the law there. And in Arizona, they are pursuing a voluntary approach because of the way the birds were introduced there. They have chosen not to pursue a regulatory approach, although there's some pressure coming from environmental groups for them to do that. So instead of banning lead rifle bullets in the places where California condors are, they've offered incentives to hunters and free ammo so that they will use this alternative. And by some measures, that's also working pretty well. So you have sort of a natural public policy experiment where one state is choosing to use the stick and prohibiting lead rifle bullets, whereas the neighboring state is using more of a carrot and offering hunters free ammunition. At the end of the day, the important thing is whether or not hunters are using lead bullets and putting condors at risk. And in the grand panoply of threats that are facing endangered species, this, to me, is actually a relatively easy one to knock off because there's an alternative that's close in price and performs just as well, if not better. So compared to something like climate change or urban sprawl, this seems like a problem we could actually knock off.
We're talking to Mitch Tobin, author of the book Endangered, Biodiversity on the Brink. Let's talk about the Endangered Species Act for a moment. It's actually an extraordinary law, and as you say, it acts more like an emergency room rather than as preventive medicine. But nevertheless, it's a law that I would guess would not have the ghost of a chance of being passed today. What does it actually say? What are its provisions?
Yeah, it's interesting because it was passed in 1973, so almost 40 years ago, and it was signed by a Republican president, Richard Nixon. And it was passed with a lot of foresight and forethought. The nation as a whole understood that it was beginning to lose species because of development that was not being tempered by any sort of regulation. And so at around the time of the first Earth Day in 1970, there was a huge wave of environmental legislation that was passed, and the Endangered Species Act was one of them. The gist of the law is that species are added to a list, and they're either labeled as threatened or an endangered species, and in many ways, those are sort of interchangeable terms. And there are now more than 1,300 species that are on that list. And once you get on the list, in a sense, aboard this legislative arc, you are shielded with a number of protections if you're a plant or an animal. And so it becomes illegal for somebody to go out and shoot you or otherwise harm or harass or destroy you. So that offers some protection. And another element of the law that's very important is that it forbids any federal agency or entity from doing anything that would potentially jeopardize a species. Now, the thing that's sort of interesting about it is that this does not only apply to federal activities or federal land like national forests or national parks. It also concerns any kind of private economic activity that has a connection to the federal government. So, for example, a federal permit or federal loans. So the law actually has a pretty broad reach, and it extends beyond public lands to private lands as well. So we've listed about more than 1,300 species, and the basic box score is that hardly any species, just a handful, have gone extinct after they've been listed by the Endangered Species Act. So the first goal of preventing extinction, the ESA is arguably doing a great job in that far less than 1% of the species that have been listed have actually gone extinct. But on the other hand, the ultimate goal of the ESA is to recover species so that they no longer need our help and are thriving. And on that count, the ESA hasn't done so great. It's only recovered about 24 or so species so that they could be delisted and, in a sense, discharged from the emergency room. So most of our endangered species are in between. They're not extinct, and so we've kept them around, which is the first and most important priority. But on the other hand, very few of them have actually recovered and are in good shape.
Why is that? Why is that?
Well, that's not to say that the Endangered Species Act is at fault, just as you wouldn't fault an emergency room doctor if somebody came in with a bullet wound in their head and they died on the emergency room table. So it's not really because of the Endangered Species Act that so few species have been recovered. But the real reason is that we haven't addressed the root causes of the endangerment. The biggest ones are habitat loss and invasive species, non-natives that come in. And now climate change is looming out there as the biggest threat of all. So in many cases, the Endangered Species Act has done an incredible job of pulling species back from the brink and keeping them from going extinct. But although it's a very powerful law and it has sharp teeth and it sometimes forces significant expenditures of money, it can't restructure our entire natural resource policy to put a greater premium on biodiversity. And so it can only do so much as one law.
One of the things at the back of your book, you have a 12-step plan for recovery, and one of the things in it is that there's a backlog of species to be listed in the Endangered Species Act. Tell us about that.
Yeah, these are species that are known as candidates, and what has happened here is that typically somebody, an environmental group, say, has asked the government to protect a plant or animal under the Endangered Species Act, and so they filed a petition. And the Fish and Wildlife Service, the agency that's mostly in charge of administering the ESA, then has to decide whether or not this species deserves to be protected by this law. And that decision is solely to be made on the basis of science. It's supposed to have nothing to do with the economic impact, for instance, of whether a species is listed or not. So the Fish and Wildlife Service only has so many employees and only has so much budget, and it's received a ton of these petitions. And so some of the species it determines are not eligible and says no. And some of the species it says, yes, the species is definitely endangered, we're going to list it. But there's this group of species that's in the middle, and there are now about 250 of them that are considered candidates. And the agency with these species has basically said, they are threatened with extinction, they deserve protection, but that's precluded by other budgetary priorities. So these species, about 250, are sort of sitting there in this regulatory purgatory, and they're not receiving any ESA protections, but the federal government has already determined that they're at risk of extinction. And the only reason that they haven't done it is that they simply haven't summoned the political will, gotten enough money from Congress, to process the listing. And obviously, many listings are opposed by economic interests that might be affected by it. So that's also a natural break on species being added to the list. So there are about 250, and the Obama administration has pledged to start addressing that backlog and adding species. And we'll see if they actually follow through on that. The last Bush administration listed very, very few species, and it remains to be seen how Obama is going to handle this issue. In his first year or so, he actually did not list very many species. But the last 8 years was a dramatic reduction in the number of species listed per year, if you look back all the way to the beginning of the law in 1973.
Let's talk about some species that have been saved by the Endangered Species Act. The Mexican gray wolf is one that we have here in New Mexico. It's been saved, but it's still not out of the woods in any way. Tell us its story.
Yeah, the Mexican gray wolf was reintroduced into Arizona and New Mexico in 1998. And this program has really not received very much attention, certainly not in comparison to the Yellowstone Wolf Recovery Program, which is considered one of the great conservation stories of our time. So the Mexican subspecies of wolf was totally extirpated from the United States. They were not found in this country at all, and they were hanging on just barely in northern Mexico. And after the Endangered Species Act was passed, and after a long, protracted political fight, eventually the Mexican gray wolf was reintroduced in 1998. Now, the program has not really been going all that well because the program was set up with a number of sort of self-defeating policies in order to get the wolves on the ground. And so if the wolves leave a certain recovery area, they're trapped and brought back into captivity. If they prey on one too many cattle, they're shot and killed. And so all of this heavy-handed management of capturing wolves and moving them around, and sometimes actually shooting them if they've been preying on cattle, has been a real break on the recovery of this species. So in the northern Rockies around Yellowstone area, the gray wolves that live up there have actually been going through the delisting process because they've become numerous enough. But in Arizona and New Mexico, the program has really been faltering. And so I write quite a bit about that in the book in terms of what some options are for potentially making this program work a little bit better. There are, for instance, programs that compensate ranchers if their cattle have been taken by a wolf. And the idea is to not overly burden livestock ranchers and hopefully figure out a way for both wolves and ranchers to coexist in the same area.
It's interesting because in New Mexico, the great majority of people are in favor of it, but the people who are most affected by it, namely ranchers, are very much against having any wolves at all. And we've recently had the shootings of some alpha wolves here in the state, which is horrifying to us. Why is it so difficult to get on the same page with people who are ranchers? For example, even those who are sometimes offered compensation for their lost livestock, of which there aren't even that many in the first place, that's not enough. They just want wolves not to be there at all.
Yeah, illegal shootings are the number one source of mortality for the Mexican gray wolf program, and it turns out that actually shootings are the number one source of mortality for wolves wherever they're reintroduced. So wolf human conflict is not something that's isolated in the Southwest. It's been a huge problem in the Northern Rockies and elsewhere. And having talked to ranchers, and I spent a lot of time with the people who live in the recovery area and who have to deal with the wolves, many of them don't like it because it makes it harder and more costly for them to do their business. And it's already a very difficult, economically marginal business to begin with. And so for people who've been ranching without the presence of wolves for many, many years since they were extirpated, largely at the behest of the livestock industry, it's a big change when there are now wolves out there. And there are some ranchers, though, who do feel like they can coexist. And so it's maybe not as much of a monolith as we would think. But ultimately, it comes down to our priorities, and our priorities not only for endangered species, but for public lands, because most of the ranchers in Arizona and New Mexico are ranching on public lands, national forest allotments, BLM allotments. And so this is very much an issue and a controversy about how we want those lands managed that we all, as Americans, own. And so I think that's why it's so controversial, is because it's tied up in that bigger issue. And, of course, I think a lot of the ranchers are resentful of the big, bad federal government because it's the United States government that's coming in and managing this program. And so I think a lot of anti-federal sentiment gets caught up in the issue as well.
Which is ironic because they are taxpayer-owned lands in the first place.
True. And the federal government spent decades exterminating predators like the wolf, jaguars, mountain lions, and others, and has done a lot to facilitate the region. And so, you know, there is a lot of strong anti-federal sentiment there, and that's obviously a much bigger issue, and it extends beyond endangered species, but it gets caught up in the debate. And so it's not necessarily a debate about the species and its biology and its needs. It becomes tied up in a much bigger philosophical debate about the role of government. And I think that this happens a lot in our endangered species battles because it is a strong law. It has teeth. It forces uncomfortable choices and therefore triggers a lot of strong emotions.
We're talking to Mitch Tobin, author of the book Endangered, Biodiversity on the Brink. The wolves are an important example because they're what's called a keystone species. Can you explain what that means and why they're important in the first place?
Sure. The experience in Yellowstone has really been incredible. Excuse me. There's been a lot of research that's come out of there that's shown that by reintroducing wolves to that ecosystem, you've had dramatic effects on all of these other species in the web of life. So it's changed the behavior of the prey animals that the wolves eat, and that in turn has affected the aspen growing along riparian areas. And it's even changed the entire hydrology of streams there. And so it's a really good example of what biologists call a trophic cascade, where reinstalling the predator at the top of the food pyramid has effects all the way down on the elk, for instance, that the wolves eat, and then where the elk browse and how they behave. And it even goes down to insects and hydrology of streams. Now, there aren't that many wolves in Arizona and New Mexico. There's only 50 or so. So it's not the same scale in terms of effects. But that is the point also of reintroducing endangered species, is to try and restore that natural web of life that was there before humans began taking out some of the pieces.
We're talking to Mitch Tobin, author of the book Endangered: Biodiversity on the Brink. There's a quotation in your book by Aldo Leopold, whom we've talked about on this show a number of times and who's a hero of so many environmentalists. And the quote is as follows. One of the penalties of an ecological education is that one lives alone in a world of wounds. Much of the damage inflicted on land is quite invisible to laymen. An ecologist must either harden his shell or make believe that the consequences of science are none of his business, or he must be the doctor who sees the marks of death in a community that believes itself well and does not want to be told otherwise. Tell us about some of the invisible damage that you have come to see living in Arizona, living in the West, and how you handle it. Because for the person who sees this damage, it's a great path of learning, but also of incredible frustration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are a lot of examples of that. I think of, first of all, the invasive species that we have in the Southwest. And I've been to these places where it looks gorgeous. There's this chest-high grass waving in the breeze, and it looks like all is right in the world, but it turns out that grass is from South Africa and is from on the other side of the earth and has had serious impacts on the native birds and insects that live in that valley. And so appearances can be deceiving. Similarly, a lot of people, when they're in the high country in the Southwest, they like seeing a very dense forest and having trees all around their house. And that may look nice to some people, but of course it's unnatural. That our ponderosa pines and the forest used to be much more spacious because we had periodic fires coming through and reducing the kindling and the fuel on the forest floor. So what we think looks natural and right is actually, in some cases, unnatural. And to me, the sort of invisible threat that I'm most concerned about is climate change and greenhouse gases. And that is a threat that could potentially affect every species in the Southwest, no matter where it lives, and every species on the planet. And that's why it's such a frightening thing, is that it has a global effect. And it doesn't necessarily manifest in a way that we can readily identify the threat. We don't see an oil spill, for example, something that's tangible, but we've got this tremendous problem that's continuing to put all of biodiversity throughout the entire planet at risk.
Climate change threatens, as you say, so many different things in our ecosystem, and that brings up a term that we've been starting to use, well, ecologists have been using it for a long time, but I've learned fairly recently, and that is the term ecosystem services. What are some examples of things that nature does for us human beings that it would cost us an absolute fortune, millions, billions, trillions of dollars, if we tried to do it ourselves?
Yeah, it's this fancy term called ecosystem services, and it's very clear that the natural world and biodiversity generates a lot of value for humans. And one of the examples I like to use is pollination. I mean, think of how much money it would cost for humans to manually pollinate all of the various crops and plants on the earth. It would be an astronomical sum. Wetlands, for instance, serve a very valuable function in terms of protecting areas from storms on the coast and also filtering water and making it cleaner. And the list goes on and on, and clearly we couldn't survive without a healthy ecosystem that was providing food and water and shelter and clothing and vital commodities like that. So people know there is some value that's being generated, and economists have even tried to actually measure that. 10 or 15 years ago, people took a stab at it and said it was about $33 trillion per year, which was double the gross national product at the time. But it can become very theoretical and difficult to understand, but I like to sort of boil it down to five different E's when it comes to the importance of protecting biodiversity. The first is ecology, and what we talked about, for example, with the wolf and the trophic cascade and how a keystone species can affect the entire web of life. There's also education, that species tell us a lot about the natural world and teach us about chemicals and things that we have no idea about until we actually start studying them. There is also this economics, that a certain species that may seem unimportant because it's a fly is actually an important pollinator of a cash crop. Another E to me is aesthetics, that it feels good inside, at least among a lot of people, to know that there are polar bears in the Arctic, even if people would never actually go and see them with their own eyes. But ultimately, I think protecting endangered species comes down to another E, and that's ethics, and whether you think it's right or wrong to drive a species extinct. And ultimately, we're going to find a lot of species in which we can't really find value for it, because it's something that lives in a deep, dark cave and eats cricket feces and never sees the light of day. And so it's hard to find economic value to protecting a species like that. And that's why I think ultimately ethics is really one of the most important justifications for protecting biodiversity. And there's a very strong tradition in cultures and religions around the world of protecting other species. And the most famous story, of course, is Noah's Ark.
There's a very poignant story that you tell toward the end of the book also, which is that your mother got cancer, and her chemotherapy was made from an extract from a tree which had, before it was discovered to have this compound in it, was considered just a kind of piece of junk plant, and then suddenly it became a very important drug.
Yeah, I tell the story of Taxol, which is one of the world's best-selling anti-cancer drugs. And the Taxol is made from a plant called the Pacific Yew, which lives in the Pacific Northwest. Now, it's not an endangered species, but it was considered for many, many decades to be a trash tree. And so when loggers would go in to get Douglas firs and other commercially valuable trees, they would just cut down the Pacific Yew and pile it up and burn it. But in the 1960s, the federal government sent out scientists and botanists to collect various plants throughout the country and the world. And eventually, scientists discovered that there was a chemical in the bark of the Pacific Yew that was an incredible anti-cancer drug. And it became known as Taxol, and billions of dollars of it have been sold since. My own mom was diagnosed with advanced ovarian cancer, and she was given Taxol, as many ovarian cancer patients are, as treatment. And unfortunately, my mom eventually passed away, but it did keep her alive for a year or so, and for that I'm grateful. And that episode to me really drove home the importance of protecting species and biodiversity, especially species that may not seem to be valuable at first blush, or may not be very charismatic, like a grizzly bear or a bald eagle. And this plant, this Pacific Yew that was considered a trash tree and burned in place because nobody thought it was much worth saving, turned out to be a drug that's saved countless lives and also made drug companies billions of dollars.
Well, and it points to a larger issue, which is that when you protect biodiversity, you are acknowledging the fact that what we're going to know about plants and animals and earth and air and the way they all work together and specific compounds and chemistry and so on, what we're going to know in 100 years, we have no idea about now. So we destroy it at our own risk.
Yeah, and you mentioned Aldo Leopold before, and of course he's an idol of mine, and I write about him quite a bit in the book, in part because he began his career in the Southwest. And the way he put it was that the last word in ignorance is the man who says of an animal or plant, what good is it? And to continue the quote that many people probably know, to keep every cog and wheel is the first precaution of intelligent tinkering. So just because we don't understand something doesn't mean we should throw it away. And even if we drive something extinct, it may not seem like the end of the world, but people use the analogy of an airplane, that you might be able to take out a couple of rivets from the wing and suffer no ill consequences. But eventually, if you take out enough of those rivets, you're going to have a catastrophic failure.
And it's interesting that both the airplane analogy and the cog and wheel analogy are mechanical metaphors that we Westerners seem to like and understand. But the natural world, while you can understand it to some extent in terms of mechanical metaphors, is far, far beyond that in ways that we're only just at the beginning of our understanding of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think this issue comes up when we think ahead about how we're going to deal with biodiversity in the 21st century in light of climate change and the limits of our understanding of nature. And if we don't get a handle on greenhouse gas emissions and global warming really takes off, we're going to be faced with decisions about whether or not to move species around in order to save them because their habitat might be underwater or otherwise destroyed. And so there's this very rich debate that's going on now among academic biologists about the wisdom and the merits of assisted migration and other heavy-handed management. And so I think this idea of treating the natural world as a machine and being very deterministic and being able to move this piece over there and have this effect is very, very tricky. And the world is littered with examples of humans doing it wrong, of introducing species to places like Australia and then taking off and decimating the natives. But that's the kind of choice that we're going to be facing, I think, more and more in coming decades, because there are certain species that are going to be so imperiled by climate change. For example, there are deer that live on the Keys in Florida. Eventually, with enough global warming, those islands will be underwater. So what do you do with the key deer? In the Southwest, in Arizona, we have the Mount Graham red squirrel, which is only found at the top of that mountain. And as temperatures continue to increase and the vegetation moves up the slope of the mountain, eventually the habitat for that species could disappear. So where would we move it? So we're already messing with nature in a very big way. And the question is whether we're going to do more harm than good by intervening and trying to save some of these species before it's too late.
We're talking to Mitch Tobin, author of the book Endangered, Biodiversity on the Brink. I was talking the other day, I had an interview with the journalist Nicholas Kristof, and he was talking about how people's empathy and generosity reside in one part of the brain, and then logic and rationality reside in another part of the brain. And if you get too much into logical thinking, you lose your empathy. And I was thinking about that when you wrote in the introduction of your book about being a journalist, and there you are looking at bats and fish and frogs eye to eye, and you said that, I felt furthest from the talking points I was transcribing on Deadline and closest to the truth. And I thought there's a lot of depth in that, and that sense of the truth and the importance of basically cohabiting the earth with all of these other species. How do you get that truth across to enough people that it has a political effect that helps these species to survive?
Well, that's a good question. I wish I had an easy answer for that, and I'm not sure if there is a way to get people to connect more with nature just by commanding it, but I think certain things that we can do will develop more empathy, as you put it. One of the things I think of right off the bat is this issue of nature deficit disorder that we've been hearing about, and how kids today spend hardly any time outdoors and spend most of their time staring at a screen or playing video games. And as I look ahead to the future, it's hard to see how people are really going to be concerned about endangered species if they've never gone out and followed the tracks of an animal on a hike, or been out and climbed the top of a mountain, or seen an animal somewhere in the wild. And if people don't have that first-hand, face-to-face experience with nature, there's very little hope in actually saving it. So I think getting people out in nature and doing things more in the natural world is one way to develop that empathy. And, I mean, to be quite cynical about it, I think people who are concerned about biodiversity realize that you have to play on people's emotions and look to charismatic species that people will care about, something like the polar bear, where people connect for one reason or another with certain types of species that are cute or cuddly or human-like or otherwise endearing. And it turns out, as I report in the book, that those are the species that tend to get the most money spent on their behalf. And so it can be a problem if we only protect species like that. But when we do protect an area for a grizzly bear, we're also protecting all of the other species that live in that area. And so in that sense, the grizzly bear serves as an umbrella species. So there's a certain strategy in terms of protecting animals that people can get excited about and can identify with in some way, as a means to protecting some of the more humble species that occupy the same habitat.
You write quite a bit in the book about groundwater and how in the West we rely on groundwater, but we don't replenish it as quickly as we take it out, and mm-hmm. urban sprawl becomes a big problem. But here's something that I and our listeners could use some help with. Every time I look at actual water use numbers, they say that 90% of water is used for agriculture. So why mm-hmm. the focus on urban water use if it's only 10% and conservation will save only a fraction of that 10%?
That's an excellent point. And I, as you said, the vast majority of water in the West is used for agriculture. And not only is it used for agriculture, it tends to be used for very low-value crops like cattle feed. And so the percentage of water that's going towards urban users and municipalities has been increasing as the Southwest is becoming bigger and bigger. But still, the vast majority of water goes towards farms. So what I think is going to happen over the next couple of decades, and it's already starting to happen, is simple economics is going to take effect, that there's going to be more and more demand for water among urban users as those populations grow. And they're going to be willing to pay top dollar for that money, and eventually will be able to offer enough money to a farmer or somebody who has a water right and be able to purchase that. So we've already started to see water markets develop in the West and elsewhere to facilitate that transfer from farms to cities. And so if that's done right, I think it actually could do a lot of good, because there's very little value generated by growing cattle feed somewhere in the desert. But it does come with some risks, because if we're simply substituting water being used in cities for water being used on the farm, that could still leave species high and dry.
And if that's a strategy that's used broadly, wouldn't it endanger our food supply?
Well, I mean, if we prohibited agriculture from using any water, we wouldn't be growing food here, but that's unlikely to happen. This is all stuff that's happening around the margins now. But we already import a lot of food that's grown outside of our borders. But, of course, it is a concern, and if you do transfer money and water between cities and farms, there's a huge economic transfer that's going on there, and a lot of heavy politics get involved as well, because a farmer, for example, might sell his water right and go out of business and be able to retire in style, but the surrounding community, the fertilizer company and the tractor company in town are going to suffer but have not received any benefit. So I think water markets are inevitable just because the supply of water in light of climate change is probably going to be going down over time, and the demand is going to be going up as the Southwest continues to grow. So the value of water is going to continue to increase. So I think you'll see more and more water use migrating from farms to cities.
We're in, as you say, a major period of species extinction, very rapid species extinction. Do you look at this human destructive activity as, in a way, just another natural phenomenon, like a meteor or another ice age? I mean, is there, what happens when you look at it that way?
Well, it's an interesting question as to whether or not it's natural. There are a bunch of scientists who now believe we've entered into a new era known as the Anthropocene, which is a time in which humans are modifying all of creation. And climate change, of course, is the best example of that. But something like 80 or 85% of the surface of the Earth, the land at least, has been altered in one way or another by humans. So we've already affected the planet tremendously, and now with climate change have a potential to do it even more. So I think we are already, I would think, in this age in which humans are modifying everything, and there really is no place on the planet that has escaped the human hand in one way or another.
Are we ourselves in danger of extinction as a species?
No, I think we're doing great, actually, because as far as population, we're, you know, growing like gangbusters and spreading throughout the Earth. So I don't think there's any risk of our own species going extinct because there's so many of us. I think the real threat is the plants and animals that are around us.
Which, however, we rely on very heavily. And if they're gone in large numbers, we're in real trouble.
Yeah, to me, the Gulf oil situation, which is really horrible, is interesting to me in the sense that I think it's a very clear case in which we no longer see this dichotomy between the environment and jobs. When we had the big spotted owl controversy, it was loggers versus owls. And those two things, environmental protection and economic health and vitality, seem to be diametrically opposed. But now you have this situation in the Gulf where you're seeing the environment getting hammered and the economy is getting hammered also, whether it's the coastal resorts or any of the fishermen there or any of the other industries that are dependent on that ecosystem to make money and to stay in business. So as horrible as the Gulf oil spill is, I think we may look back at it as a turning point when people started to see that protecting the environment and having a healthy economy are not mutually exclusive. In fact, they depend on one another.
Mitch Tobin is author of the book Endangered, Biodiversity on the Brink. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much, Mary Charlotte. I've really enjoyed it.